And maybe they can take advantage of that and try and de-escalate this incredibly dangerous situation. To which I'll return, I'm sure. It's 11 o'clock, time for the labor hour. So did you hear that Sawant was against the $15 an hour Seattle proposal?
That's a complicated story.
Well, you know, it's
that's a complicated story. Basically, what's happened is that the mayor of Seattle and the Democratic Party are trying to water it down by saying
3 to 7 years.
Yeah, well, not only that.
What does that mean? Three to seven years.
Not only that, but they're defining small businesses as any business that has 250 employees or less. I mean, that's nonsense. The other thing is
500 employees.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. 500 in Seattle. Yeah. 250 is what they were talking about originally. And the other thing is,
I don't understand what that means. Actually,
well, basically, that if you're a small business under their definition, that it'll take 7 years for their workers to get the $15 an hour. Then on top of that, they want to make it to where the $15 an hour is including any kind of tips or health care benefits or anything like that. So anyway, they're Kashama Sawant and the Socialist Alternative, what they're doing is they've already filed a paperwork for a voter referendum because they were kind of suspecting this was going to happen.
Right.
So they're going to take it to the voters here.
Make it a real authentic
in November.
$15 an hour. Yeah,
there's some other unsavory characters in the background too, unfortunately, including some SEIU union leadership and others that are trying to, you know, basically, you know, placate the bosses in the Democratic Party too. So it's a complicated story. I mean, you know, it's in fact, we probably need to do a whole program on it here sometime soon.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll return to it at least a little bit. The labor hour at hand, a little foreshadowing, and thanks for listening.
Working class, we're just not working anymore.
Hello, folks, and welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you in the air on listener-supported community radio station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois, 90.1 FM, and webcasting live worldwide at weft.org. Views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Bob with some of our underwriting announcements.
The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio. And programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the Illinois Education Association Union. The Illinois Education Association's mission is to effect excellence and equity in public education and to be the advocacy organization for all public education employees. And this hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, call 217-328-2295. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And finally, programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour.
Okay, thank you, Bob. I want to thank everybody who made pledges over the 3 weeks of our spring pledge drive. We really appreciate it very much. And, of course, we finished well short of our goal. So we're going to need to ask our listeners for additional pledges here in the near future. But we're going to take 2 weeks off first, return to our regular programming. But you can still support us in the meantime by calling 217-359-9338. 217-359-9338.
We took those 2 weeks off.
9338.
Oh, my. The spring pledge drive resumed last night at 6 o'clock. So we're back in pledge drive mode. So give us a call.
Yes.
217-359-9338. Or go to the website, weft.org.
And don't forget the denim shirt at the $150 level.
Yeah.
Remember that? $120 was what? A cap, T-shirt?
Three thank you gifts. So, yeah, you could get three T-shirts or any combination of a T-shirt, tote bag, or a baseball cap.
Okay. Well, this was laying here right next to the monitor, so yeah. I thought I had to read it. It said, read once per show. But anyway, again, that number is 217-359-9338.
There's newer signs over here, Dave, that say pledge drive. This pledge drive resumes. There was an email that went out yesterday that said it started at 6 o'clock again last night.
Well, I didn't check my email. So anyway, welcome, everybody. This is going to be kind of our May Day show. We also have a very special guest today here coming in close to half past the hour, Dan Gilbert, who's a professor at the University of Illinois School of Labor. And I guess we'll start off. Bob's going to have a couple news stories here, and then I got a kind of a brief history of the origins of May Day.
All right. Here's a story that was happening last weekend. It just wrapped up. It says most of tens of thousands of workers who were striking at a massive Chinese shoe factory complex have returned to the job. Labor activists said last Saturday, enabling Adidas to resume production there. The Germany-based athletic wear giant said workers returned last Friday to its factory run by Taiwanese-owned Yuyuan Industrial Holdings, the world's largest manufacturer of athletic shoes. More than 40,000 workers at Yuyuan's sprawling multi-factory complex in the southern Chinese city of Dongguan went on strike in early April to protest underpayments into their Social Security and housing funds. It was one of the largest strikes ever in Chinese private sector, where low-cost manufacturers are facing increasing labor activism amid a shortage of migrant workers pushing up labor costs. Yu Yuen makes shoes for major brands including Adidas, Nike, and New Balance, which are increasingly looking to other countries to source their production. And labor activists confirmed last Saturday that most Yu Yuen workers, including those assigned to the Adidas factory, had returned to work, although about 10,000 still remained on strike. And the workers have not reached a deal with the company, which has offered to pay full contributions starting May 1st. The company rejected workers' demands for a 30% pay raise and back payments into their Social Security funds. Now, it says here, too, Chinese police have charged a labor activist with creating a public disturbance over the Internet during the major strike. Says that this gentleman named Lin Dong, that they moved against him. It said that they actually detained two men, and then they released one of them, but they still continue to hold this guy, Lin Dong. It says, following 10 days of protest, the Dongguan government had backed the workers who claimed that Yu Yuen had failed to pay pension contributions required by Chinese law. Activists said the authorities also used a heavy police presence to put pressure on the workers to return to work. So, we'll see. That's kind of interesting over there.
Yeah, I can
see. Huge factory, 40,000 workers in one factory.
That is
making shoes for almost all of the major brands, Adidas, Nike, New Balance, like that. You know, it's just.
I look for them to move to Burma and then finally probably to Central Africa or somewhere.
Cambodia, yeah. You know,
Africa.
Yep, Africa's going to be the new frontier for all these sweatshop factories, I can guarantee you. Yeah. After Burma, of course, because they just opened up relations with Burma just a few years ago, you know.
Yeah.
And it wasn't out of the goodness of their heart. I mean, the day I saw Hillary Clinton go there, I thought, oh, yep, she's getting pressure for the Manufacturers Association. Need some
call
cheaper labor.
Myanmar now, or is it back to Burma? Didn't Burma change their name to Myanmar or
something? But most people know it as Burma. Myanmar is the correct name, yes.
Is it?
Yes, it is.
Well, I get confused these days.
Okay. It reflects our age, too, you know.
Yeah.
So do you have another news story? Or?
Actually, kind of leading into your May Day stuff here.
Okay.
I talk a little bit about May Day demonstrators, denounced low wages and calls for reforms and rallies that turned violent in Cambodia and Turkey, where police cracked down on participants defying a ban on public protests. In Russia, the Philippines, Malaysia, Iran, and Iraq, demonstrators marched peacefully in support of International Workers' Day, calling for higher wages and decrying government corruption. It says clashes erupted in Istanbul between May Day demonstrators and riot police as crowds determined to defy a government ban tried to march to the city's iconic Taksim Square. It says security measures failed to deter thousands of people from marching to mark May Day at spots throughout the city as well as in other cities in Turkey. About 40 people were hospitalized and about 160 detained. Before being declared a national holiday in 2009, May 1st was a day of conflict that often led to violence across Turkey. In 1977, 34 people were killed in Taksim Square during a May Day event when shots were fired into the crowd from a nearby building. It says in the Cambodian capital of Phnom Penh, nearly 1,000 factory workers and supporters of the opposition Cambodia National Rescue Party gathered outside the city's Freedom Park, which had been sealed off with barbed wire, with hundreds of police on guard. This is Freedom Park.
It's pretty ironic.
That's like the Clean Air Act under Bush or something.
Right. You know. Says witnesses said civilian auxiliary police, which are often used by the government to break up protests, armed themselves with clubs and turned on the demonstrators after opposition leaders spoke to the crowd and left the rally sites. The assaults appeared to be random and limited, and they were over in less than an hour, but at least five people were injured. In Moscow, about 100,000 people marched through Red Square past the red granite mausoleum of Vladimir Lenin, marked the first time the annual parade has been held on the vast cobblestone square outside the Kremlin since the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991. So, interesting things there. In the Philippines, thousands of workers marched peacefully in Manila, and thousands of Malaysians, meanwhile, held a peaceful protest and other peaceful protests, but that was kind of marking International Workers' Day, May 1st.
Okay. Yeah, and I want to go into a little history of that, but I have a couple of emails that I got a couple days ago, from one from London, one from Berlin. I guess the one from London will start with, thousands joined the May Day March through London yesterday. The event was billed as a commemoration of Bob Crowe and Tony Benn, who both died very recently. Bob Crowe was the leader of the RMT Railway and Maritime Union, and there were very large groups of members of the union present from all over the country. The first speaker from the plinth of Nelson's column in Trafalgar Square was Crowe's young daughter. She is a TUSC candidate, and elections taking place later in the month. The current national president of RMT, who followed, also spoke along the political lines of the Trades Union and Socialist Coalition. In Berlin, this report came in, tens of thousands of anti-capitalist and anti-fascist demonstrators on May Day in Berlin, mass demos and anti-Nazi rallies in Hamburg, Dortmund, Lübeck, and many other German towns. One large rally in front of the SPD, Socialist Party, Democratic Party headquarters in Berlin, chants 100 years of social democrats, 100 years of counter-revolution. All tiny Nazi demos were routed and demoralized, and 40,000 left youth attended the May Day Fest after the demonstration parties in Berlin. So it looks like different parts of the world have different experiences. You know, my wife, being from Germany originally, stated that, you know, May Day was a combination of sort of, you know, Labor Day and a couple other 4th of July and a bunch of other holidays thrown in. You know, it was kind of a day to go and, you know, for working people to march and show their support, but also it was quite a day for partying as well. And it has even, you know, of course, roots that go way, way back into ancient times as well.
Right, right. There were some kind of mixed things up in Seattle, too. Ironic that that was the day that the mayor's proposal came out about the minimum wage. And there was peaceful protests throughout most of the day, but some of those turned somewhat rowdy in the evenings and stuff as some anti-capitalists marched, and police made about 10 arrests up there. There were some fires and firecrackers and things like that. Apparently they did use some tear gas or pepper spray in one incident up there in Seattle. So,
Yeah, that $15 an hour minimum wage proposal is complicated. I really want to do a show here. I've got some guests scheduled for the next Saturday or two, but I want to get our West Coast correspondent John Ryman to call in, because he actually made two trips up to Seattle here just in the last 2 months.
Right. And we had him on a couple.
He was here in person in Champaign back in October of 2008, and then of course he's called in a couple times. That's why I call him our West Coast Labor Hour correspondent.
He called in just about a month ago. He had just been up in Seattle,
right? Yes, and he's been back a couple times, actually. So he's got some interesting reports, and it's complicated.
Real complicated.
Yeah.
If you read the Working in These Times article about it, it takes about four paragraphs for them to spell out all of the different rules and regulations, because there's about seven categories of businesses. They're all affected differently. They all get phased in, whether it's 3 years, 4 years, or 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were talking about Kashama Sawant, she says every year of phase-in is another year that a worker has to live in poverty.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. I mean, that's interesting. And so she's somewhat happy, but she says we have to keep fighting. We'll keep building the pressure from below.
Mm-hmm. That's what has to happen.
Right.
Well, see, that's why you need more workers on that city council, because especially low-wage ones, because they will be the ones experiencing it. The people on that council aren't.
No, most, except for Kashama Sawant, almost everybody on that council is a millionaire.
Right.
You know, just like sort of the city of Chicago is now, you know, more or less. But anyway, I want to talk a little bit about just the origins of May Day here. You know, most people live in the United States know little about the International Workers' Day of May Day. I mean, this is May Day is Labor Day for the entire world except the United States, which is quite ironic, actually. For many, there's assumptions that's a holiday celebrated in communist countries like Cuba or the former Soviet Union. But most Americans, you know, don't realize that May Day has its origins here in this country. In fact, in Chicago. And it's as American as baseball and apple pie. It also stems from the pre-Christian pagan holiday of Beltane, a celebration of rebirth and fertility. I guess hence the maypole. Anyway, in the late 19th century, you know, the working class, in the United States and Europe was in constant struggle to gain the 8-hour workday. Working conditions were severe, and it was quite common to work 10 to 16-hour days. That's 10 to 16 hours in one day in unsafe conditions. Death and injuries were commonplace at many workplaces, and these The conditions inspired such books as Upton Sinclair's The Jungle and Jack London's The Iron Heel. And as early as the 1860s, working people agitated to shorten the work day without a cut in pay, but it wasn't until the late 1880s that the organized labor was able to garner enough strength to declare the 8-hour workday. This proclamation at its national convention in Chicago in 1884, made by the Federation of Organized Trades and Labor Unions, which was the predecessor of the American Federation of Labor, the AFL, proclaimed that 8 hours shall constitute a legal day's labor from and after May 1st, 1886. And, you know, this the following year, the Federation of Trade Unions Labor, backed by many Knights of Labor locals, reiterated their proclamation stating that it would be supported by strikes and demonstrations. So for May, an estimated 250,000 workers in the Chicago area became directly involved in the crusade to implement the 8-hour day. And anyway, it was the entire city of Chicago, I guess, was prepared for mass bloodshed because they remembered just a short 10 years earlier the Great Railroad Strike in which police and soldiers gunned down hundreds of striking workers. May 1st, 1886.
Oh, Dave.
Yes.
That's also known as the
Great
Uprising of 1877.
Yes,
something, yes. A very small, I mean, not very small, but a very unknown but major event.
In labor history and American history. Yes, yes, indeed.
I mean, that's why National Guard armories are built in all these towns, and they're built so that they, with gun ports, because they're afraid that they might have had to retreat to the armories.
I see. Well, that's an interesting fact, Bill. Wow. Okay. You know, come to think of it, this one just 2 blocks away over on the corner of, would that be, that'd be Park Street and Second?
Second.
Yeah. Looks like a fortress, actually, come to think of it. Okay, so on May 1st, 1886, more than 3 million workers in 13,000 businesses across the United States walked off their jobs in the first May Day celebration in history. In Chicago, the epicenter of the 8-hour day, agitators, 40,000 went on strike and marched down Michigan Avenues. The names of many, Albert Parsons, Johann Most, August Spies, and Louis Ling, became household words in Chicago and throughout the country. Parades, bands, and tens of thousands of demonstrators in the streets exemplified the workers' strength and unity, yet didn't become violent as the newspapers and authorities predicted. More and more workers continued to walk off their jobs until the number swelled to nearly 100,000 in Chicago, yet peace prevailed. And it wasn't until 2 days later, May 3rd, 1886, that's exactly, you know, from today, however many hundred and some, whatever, I can't do the math quick enough, that violence broke out at the McCormick Reaper Works between police and strikers. For 6 months, armed Pinkerton agents, the police harassed and beat locked-out steel workers as they picketed. Anyway, I guess after a while, the picketers got fed up and they started throwing rocks at the police, and the police responded with gunfire, killing 2 strikers and wounding dozens of others. Full of rage, a public meeting was called by some of the labor people the following day on the May 4th at Haymarket Square, which is just off Halsted Street, to discuss the police brutality. Due to bad weather and short notice, only about 3,000 to 10,000 of people showed up. The affair included families with children, and the mayor of Chicago himself even came and spoke to the crowd. And everything remained calm and orderly. Anyway, as the speech wound down, 2 detectives rushed to the main police station, reporting that a speaker was using inflammatory language, which incited the police to march on the speaker's wagon and the crowd. As the police began to disperse the already thinning crowd, a bomb was thrown into the police ranks. No one knows who threw the bomb, but speculations varied from blaming any one of the workers there to an agent provocateur working for the police. Enraged, the police fired into the crowd. The exact number of civilians killed or wounded has never been determined, but an estimated 7 or 8 civilians died and up to 40 were wounded. One police officer died immediately, and another 7 died in the following weeks. Later evidence indicated that only one of the police deaths could be attributed to the bomb, and that all the other police fatalities had or could have been due to the police's own gunfire, just indiscriminate fire. And anyway, 8 labor activists, Albert Parsons, August Spies, Samuel Fielden, Oscar Niebe, Michael Schwab, George Engel, and Adolf Fischer, and Louis Ling were arrested and convicted of murder. Though only 3 were even present at the Haymarket, and those 3 were in full view of all when the bombing occurred. They were up on the bandwagon. Anyway, the jury in the trial was comprised of business leaders and a gross mockery of justice similar to the Sacco and Vanzetti case 30 years later, or the trials of the American Indian Movement Black Panther members in the 1970s. The entire world watched as these eight organizers were convicted, not for their actions, of which all were innocent, but for their political and social beliefs. And on November 11, 1887, after many failed appeals, Parsons, Spies, Engel, and Fisher were hung to death. Louis Ling died under mysterious circumstances in a cell. Supposedly, he committed suicide with a blasting cap placed in his mouth. That's sort of a little bit questionable. But anyway, the remaining organizers, Fielden, Nieb, and Schwab, were pardoned 6 years later by Illinois Governor Altgeld, who publicly lambasted the judge on a travesty of justice. And immediately after the Haymarket Massacre, big business and government conducted what some say was the very first Red Scare in this country. Anyway, today we see tens of thousands of activists embracing the ideals of the Haymarket Martyrs and those who established May Day as an International Workers' Day. Ironically, May Day is an official holiday in 66 countries and unofficially celebrated many more, but rarely is it recognized in the United States where it began. And it's interesting because over 100 years have passed since the first May Day. In the early part of the 20th century, the U.S. government tried to curb the celebration and further wipe it from the public's memory by establishing Law and Order Day on May 1st. And then, yes. And then later, I see in recent times, I even saw an ad in the newspaper earlier in the week. It was Prayer Day.
Oh, yeah.
Is the new one. I guess they've kind of decided to go to commit that, you know, not to do the push the Law and Order Day, but now it's considered Prayer Day.
Well, that kind of goes to its pagan roots too.
You know, that's
and
true.
The maypole.
Yes,
it
yes.
Stands around the maypole, you know.
But anyway, if you want to see the Haymarket Martyrs are buried in a suburb of Chicago. It's in Forest Park, Illinois, which is, I mean, you can see the I-90, the Eisenhower Expressway from the cemetery where they're buried, which is in Forest Home Cemetery. It's on Desplaines Avenue, 800 block of Desplaines Avenue in Forest Park. And it's, like I said.
Oh, I thought it was called Waldheim.
Well, it's Waldheim / Forest Home.
Oh, okay.
Forest Home. Waldheim is Forest Home in German.
Oh.
Okay, and they changed the name. But anyway, it's quite an interesting monument, and it's very interesting right around the monument of all the various labor and socialists and anarchists. Activists that are buried next to the Haymarket Martyrs. There's Emma Goldman's buried there, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, William Z. Foster, and quite a few other people. I mean, it's quite quite interesting. And, of course, you see signs. There's a lot of people that make pilgrimages there. You see all sorts of little flowers and various little, you know, mementos that are left there. And it's really interesting. I mean, it's a fascinating part of history. But the main point is that May Day has, you know, it's it's a time to where not just celebrating the whole, you know, the working people, but also to realize what it was that, what sacrifices had to be made in order to get things that people take for granted now, like the 8-hour day and the 40-hour week and the weekend. However, we're fastly losing that. I mean, it's getting to the point to where the 8-hour day and the weekend doesn't mean a whole lot, especially to people that, say, work in the service industry.
Well, Dave, I kind of bring up sometimes among fellow anarchists who are people who don't want to do anything but just completely destroy capitalism and have anarchism. You know, they don't. They're really worried about incrementalism. You know, it's going to have to be the total revolution or anything. Well, the thing is, man, the revered Haymarket anarchists, they were not fighting for the destruction of capitalism on that day. They were going for the 8-hour work day, which was a reform, even though at that time it might have been considered somewhat revolutionary. And I just think that, I don't know, I think that reforms build upon reforms, and that we should remember that.
Yes, indeed. I always look at this, I think that anyone, you know, the way I look at it is that I think people need to do whatever it takes to not just improve the standard of living of working people, but also to empower working people.
Right.
I think they both go hand in hand. And sometimes you can build on, like you said, you call it reforms, improvements in standard of living. You can use that as a stepping stone. I mean, anything that improves things, that empowers and improves, I'm all for, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, look, you're not comfortable going out in the street or something or throwing a bomb or whatever. You can write a letter. You know, to somebody or something.
Yeah.
You know, but if we all would do something, it's sort of like...
Not that Bill's advocating somebody throw a bomb. No, he's just making
a... Well, that's just kind of part of what we're talking about today. Yeah. There is also the interesting history of the statue, the memorial to the police, which had to be moved several times.
Yes. You know, right now it's in the internal courtyard of the police... Chicago Police Training Academy.
Oh, well, I guess it's safe there. Yeah. Don't get blown up or hit by a streetcar.
Yes, indeed. That's another interesting story, yes, because they put up on the site, instead of a monument to the workers killed, they put up a statue of a cop with his arm extended and it's inscribed in the name of the law.
Oh, Dave, you know? I don't know if there's any way to get this anymore, but several years ago, the League of Revolutionaries for New America was pretty strong, and they were in Chicago, and they were doing a lot, including producing radio programs.
Interesting.
And we had a CD of them doing like an audio tour of the Haymarket area.
Oh, interesting.
And, you know, they point out that the only thing there is like a little plaque.
Yes, there is there is now a sculpture a wagon and some people, like, you know, like look like the bandwagon. And it's always controversial. I mean, our friend Marty Collins has done two films called Trainwreck of Ideologies. Native. Yes, yes. But anyway, we've taken up a little bit too much time here. I want to go to some quick public service announcements. We're going to take a quick music break, and then we're going to give the rest of the time to our distinguished guest, Dan Gilbert. So May 3rd, in honor of Pete Seeger's legacy of social and environmental justice, come out and join us for a huge community potluck tonight with singing, tabling, local groups, and a party at the IMC at 5 p.m. Don't miss out on this amazing lineup of events. See you there. The Rally for Working Families next Saturday. Bruce Rainer, the billionaire anti-union candidate for governor, will be speaking at the Champaign County Republicans' annual Lincoln Day luncheon at the Paris Hilton Hotel. I'm sorry, the Hilton Gardens Hotel.
Plans. Oh, is that the same one where we had the great big thing?
Yes, yes.
A couple years ago.
Yes, and the only hotel in town built with non-union labor.
But instead of having 5,000 people show up there when it was being built non-union, we have 5,000 people show up there just because they're kind of pissed because the governor of Indiana's.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's going to be next Saturday. They'll be in the parking lot, assembled the parking lot across the Assembly Hall on the corner of Oak and Kirby. And there'll be labor leaders and politicians give a few quick remarks. I'm going to be covering that live, actually, until about 11:15, and I'm going to run over here to the station. So stay tuned for that. I'll give you a little live report in the first part of the labor hour. Also, on Thursday, May 24th, a number of organizations will be holding the lobby day for National Single-Payer Healthcare in Washington, D.C. And there's going to Congressman John Conyers and Andy Coates, MD, President of Physicians for National Health Program, will kick off the day. And they're going to be lobbying different congressmen. And if you're interested in attending, or if you'd like to go and help the citizens, public citizen, make appointments to see your congressman, you can contact all unions for single payer care health care in Louisville, Kentucky, at area code 502-636-1551. That's 502-636-1551. And finally, dear peace enthusiasts, peace demonstration, because the wars are not over. Troops are not home. Targeted assassinations continue. Veterans' benefits are backlogged. And our government continues to entertain the idea of sending troops into more countries. Public needs to be reminded the U.S. wars continue, and unless the people do something about it, our government will continue them endlessly. Once a month for two short hours, you could be doing something peace-related. Join us today, May 3rd, from 2 to 4 in downtown Champaign at the corners of Neal Street and May Street, and we have signs, or you can bring your own.
Okay. Uno Mas, Dave. Uno Mas.
Oh, okay.
Hey, Blues Jam benefit for Mama Mary Clark. That's tomorrow, starting at 2 p.m. at the Boomerang on Washington Street in Urbana. Mary Clark was a extremely wonderful blues singer and human being, and her family and friends need a little help with her memorial expenses. From 2 to 2:30 p.m., you'll see Kilbourne Alley, one of the biggest blues bands in this area. From 2:30 to 2:45, two of my former yoga classmates, Dorothy Martirano and Kristen Johns, and also Megan Johns, but she wasn't in the class. And 3 p.m., the Impalas. 4 p.m., Paul Sabuco and friends. 5 p.m., Candy Foster. 6 p.m., John Dreyer and Groove Avenue. Followed by an all-star jam from 7 to 10 p.m. with Kevin Kohlravy, Bob Watson, Popeye Kurtzinger, Crazy Johnny, Brendan Gamble, Dave Cooper, Catfish Evans, Kathy Harden, and more. There will be raffles for prizes throughout the day, as well as a 50-50 raffle drawing to be held between 7 and 8 p.m. And folks, announcements like these and the ones Dave had are things that you're probably not going to hear on WDWS, and you're definitely not going to hear it on WLS during Rush Limbaugh or something like that.
Yes.
You probably won't hear them on AM 580 either.
Any corporate radio, you won't hear this.
So that is a really good idea to donate to WEFT during this pleasure drive and a half. I guess.
Okay, 1.5. Okay. All right, very good. We're going to take
version 1.5.
Yes, we're going to take a quick music break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned. Okay, that was Ann Feeney, Whatever Happened to the 8-Hour Day, and we're back, and I want to welcome our distinguished guest, Dan Gilbert. Dan, welcome back to the World Labor Hour.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Happy Law and Order Day.
Oh, that was good. Anyway, so we're going to have you on the show, I guess. We're going to talk about several things, but maybe we should talk about the most important one first, and that's what's been going on at the University of Illinois as well as up in Chicago with faculty organizing.
Yeah, our colleagues up at the University of Illinois Chicago just after a far too long series of negotiations, were able to settle their first contracts. So both tenure track and tenured faculty and our non-tenure track colleagues have now wonderful, really wonderful contracts that include some really, really great stuff like significant increases in salary, mm-hmm. big retroactive pay raise of 6.75%, multi-year contracts for non-tenure track faculty, which is a huge deal. You know, a majority of college professors in this country are non-tenure track, don't mm-hmm. have the benefits of job security that goes with tenure. And so for folks who are in that category up at UIC, now they have the opportunity to have some job security, to be able to know that they've got a job the next year, and even in the contract, even for those folks who don't yet have access to multi-year contracts, they will have now notification of reappointment by June, which may not sound like a big deal, but for a ton of our colleagues, both here and around the country, you know, you might not know if you're going to be hired until a couple of weeks before the...
Are you kidding?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, you know, Dan, me and Dave, we're in the building trades, and we kind of know what it's like not to know if you got a job coming up.
And it's,
it's not good.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's something interesting. I read about an adjunct professor. She was, I think, at least middle-aged. And this story was about 2 or 3 months ago, who they found starved to death.
Oh,
right.
It was an amazing story, man. I wish
Pittsburgh, I think.
You know, Jill Barry, when he was here with his wife, Helena, he had a really, they conducted an interesting course on labor film history, and or not history, but just labor and films. And they showed one about the plight of adjunct, faculty. And it's funny because they transposed the opening scene from Harvest of Shame when everyone was lining up to get on the trucks to go out to the fields. And I had no idea that...
It's like a shape up.
Yes. And I had no idea what kind of job insecurity people in academia had. I mean, there was one guy who was in his early 60s that never was able to get tenure. And he was out in the L.A. area, and he'd worked at four different universities and community colleges. I don't think he even had health care unless he was paying for it himself. And it's like, it was shocking. I had no idea just how corporatized the university has become over the decades.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot to be down about these days in the labor movement and these days at universities which really are running more and more like corporations. But the growth of faculty organizing, and particularly organizing by non-tenure track folks, is really an extraordinary sign of hope, both for the future of the labor movement and for the future of universities. You know,
now up in Chicago, I was reading just a little bit of something about that, and then originally they had one union, but then they had to break it into separate as tenured and non-tenured.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, initially the organizing drive at UIC was everybody who teaches organizing together, and mm-hmm. then through some legal decisions that eventually got split into two bargaining units. But what's really important, I think, about what happened there is that even though they ultimately settled two contracts, one for tenure track and tenured and one for non-tenure track, the all the faculty acted together and, mm-hmm. and continued to act like, and in fact, are one local with two chapters. And tenure track and tenured faculty have insisted that their non-tenure track colleagues are colleagues and mm-hmm. co-workers, and have refused the false distinctions that the university administration has introduced into the mm-hmm. workforce. That, you know, that those folks over there who aren't tenured or tenure track, you know, those folks aren't like you, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And
divine conquer.
And for, you know, non-tenure track folks,
it's sort of like electricians talking about laborers. Uh-huh.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a victory in itself. The fact that the two different, the tenured and non-tenured, actually, you know, stuck together on this. What's going on here at the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana?
Yeah, so, you know, it's no secret that there's an organizing drive underway on our campus here, and I know, you know, having talked to colleagues around campus, we've been watching what's been going on in Chicago for the last couple of years, and are really excited about it. And mm-hmm. you know, I think we'll continue to see some exciting, hopefully exciting developments on this campus. One thing that happened actually right after, like literally seemingly hours after we got news of the contract settlement up at UIC, was the top campus administrators here sent out an email to campus saying that from this point forward there will be a new minimum salary for non-tenure track faculty, kind of right like that. They instituted this, and so it's, you know, it's clearly evidence of the ways in which our colleagues up at Chicago standing up and working together for change has influenced, you know,
yes.
the way that campus politics work, and I think it's a sign of the power of collective action. You mm-hmm. know, the more that we, in whatever workplace we're in, you know, stand up together, the more incentive the administrators will have to try to, you know, introduce, you know, strategies maybe to have us not want to unionize. But,
yes,
and there's also among much of the public a stereotype of professors. Let's say that they are, you know, really pretty upper middle class, or at least they're compensated that way. But they only have to teach like 3 or 6 hours a week, you know, like that. Like there's nothing more to it than just being at this room at this time.
Right.
And I did find a story about this woman, and basically they're saying here that. This is her lawyer writing. Unlike a well-paid tenured professor, Margaret Mary worked on a contract basis from semester to semester with no job security, no benefits, and with a salary of $3,000 to $3,500 per three-credit course. Okay, that would be, I guess, per semester. And she had been receiving cancer treatment, and that's without benefits.
Right.
You know, and she was 83 years old. So it's, I'm not saying, you know, you don't want to think that, oh, her job killed her. But it didn't support her very well. Mm-hmm. And she'd been homeless by that time.
Oh,
she'd
wow.
run out of money. She couldn't afford to maintain and heat her house. And then in spring, she'd been told that her contract would not be extended after the current semester.
So she's still teaching in her early
80s.
Dead. I know she's dead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, she was teaching still up into her early
80s. Yeah, because she had to.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Wow.
So we had a caller call in. He wondered if you had some thoughts on the James Kilgore situation locally here.
Yeah, so my colleague James Kilgore has been teaching as a non-tenure track faculty member on campus and is an incredibly highly regarded scholar and teacher and as many of your listeners know, is a wonderful member of the community. And
yes, he's been on the Labor Hour, in fact, twice, talking about various labor incidents and developments in South Africa, along with Professor Ken Salo.
Yeah.
He's been a real help. I mean, basically, he's been very much quite a resource for this program.
Right. Yeah, very knowledgeable.
And after some pieces published in the local newspaper about James's past and mm-hmm. and the time he served in prison after living in South Africa for a number of years, these. In the aftermath of these pieces in the News Gazette, James received out of the blue word that he wouldn't be rehired mm-hmm. To teach in the future at the U of I without any explanation, and so there have been a number of petitions, circulating. One signed by faculty members, others signed by members of the community, I think the administration announced this week that there'll be a committee to look into James's appointment. It's an example of the ways in which non-tenure track faculty have very few rights at all on campus without the protections of a union contract. You know, one of the things that union contracts do is provide grievance procedures,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So that our non-tenure track colleagues at Illinois Chicago now have language in the contract that says you can't be, disciplined or discharged unless there's just cause. And
yes.
And
this was based on something that happened in his past some 30-some years ago, nothing that he did while he was in the employment of the University of Illinois in recent years. This is what's, I think, especially disturbing about this whole incident.
Yeah, and James, brings an extraordinary body of knowledge and expertise and care about his subject to the university, and I couldn't feel more strongly that our university would be significantly worse off without him, and I also feel very strongly that our university would be much better with not only with James mm-hmm. but with the. With the protections of grievance procedures
Indeed.
And other kinds of things.
And compare his case to that former, was he president or chancellor, Hogan? All those misproprieties, and here it took forever to get rid of him, and it didn't really get, they just put him over in Springfield, and he teaches one class and is getting this six-figure salary. I mean,
right.
What a contrast, Isn't that amazing?
It's quite a contrast.
So anyway, you had some other things you wanted to talk about, some conferences coming up?
Yeah, with a couple exciting things going on over at the School of Labor and Employment Relations, where I teach,
mm-hmm.
One of my favorite parts about my job is every summer we have 4 weeks of educational conferences with members of the United Steelworkers.
Mm-hmm.
It's been happening actually since the summer of 1947.
Steelworkers
have been coming mm-hmm. and being in residence on campus. They study everything from labor history to very detailed contract and grievance and other issues. So that kicks off in the first week of June. We also have this year, for the first time in a while, our campus is hosting something called the Midwest School for Women Workers, which is an annual school for women workers, women who are union members. It gets hosted in various parts of the Midwest, and we're hosting it here on campus the week of June 22nd. And registration is now open, and folks can find out more about it by going on the School of Labor Employment Relations website. But it's going to be a really exciting conference. Karen Lewis from the Chicago Teachers Union is going to come down and be one of our keynote speakers, and so we're really excited about that too.
Okay, great. We're going to take a quick music break, and we're going to come back with Dan Gilbert. You're listening to World Labor Hour on Mrs. Breaking Radio Station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. We'll be right back. Okay, that was Tom Morello with a classic labor song, Which Side Are You On? And Bill?
I'd like to get this announcement out here pretty quick. We just got a call, and there is a ministerial alliance meeting going on at Bishop Ed McGee's church.
Okay, and where's that at?
I don't know. The caller said that the people who would be responding would know. And it's going on now. It actually started at 11. It runs to 1 o'clock. They're having pizza at 12:30, and I guess there's a lot of community leaders there and church leaders and the people involved just wanted more families to come and be part of it.
Okay.
If that was the church that Aaron Ammons was mentioning this morning, it was like 400 West Bradley Avenue, kind of right at the triangle there on Bradley and Bloomington Road.
Near where I live.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hell's Triangle, I call it that. Because I moved into the neighborhood.
Good place for a church then, you know?
Or an exorcism, right? But anyway, some final thoughts, Dan, about, I don't know, just anything. What's on your mind these days?
Well,
that's a loaded question, I know.
No, I think, you know, talking about these schools that we have coming up at the Labor Institute on campus, it's a reminder of the ways in which the Illinois labor movement has really helped shape the curriculum of the University of Illinois. You know, we exist as a school because in the 40s the labor movement got together and pushed through a resolution that said there ought to be a labor school on campus.
Learning and labor, is that not the motto of the university?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, and I used to love that. You had a great labor library in your building. Yeah. Unfortunately, it was moved to the General Stacks, I guess, or somewhere else. But I remember being unemployed during the wintertime and going over there, and oh man, it was some real treasures I found there in the stacks.
One of my heroes, the folklorist Archie Green, who taught here for a long time, was originally hired as a librarian at the Institute. And so that's a really important history.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Bill or Bob, anything you'd like to, last thoughts or anything on this May Day dedication program?
Oh, yes. May Day, as far as it being a call for help,
mm-hmm.
Is thought to been derived from the French expression, and I'll try and pronounce this,
mm-hmm.
Venez m'aider.
Okay.
Which meaning, come help me.
Okay.
And it is used as to signal a life-threatening emergency, primarily by mariners and aviators, but in some countries, local organizations such as police forces, firefighters, and transportation organizations also use the term. The call is always given 3 times in a row,
uh-huh.
Mayday, 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 to prevent mistaking it for some similar sounding phrase such as Venez m'aider. And under noisy conditions, and to distinguish an actual May Day call from a message about a May Day call, which I guess would be a meta May Day call.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Fascinating.
Just remind again about that benefit for Mary Clark tomorrow at the Boomerangs, starting at 2:00. And you know, she played sang last year at the WEF Fest in October.
Okay.
And really sweet person, as Bill said, you know, mm-hmm. well known as a great person as well as a great R&B blues singer, soul singer around town for many years. So come out and help her family a little bit with her memorial expenses tomorrow. That'd be great.
Yes, and it will be her peers as great blues musicians who will be playing here, all the people that we listed. And by the way, the Boomerang is located on East Washington, just east of Philo Road,
mm-hmm.
about, a block or two next to a car wash or something.
Yeah, it's kind of on Philo Road, yes.
You know, uh-huh. about 2 blocks west of the famous Silver Bullet.
Okay, or the infamous, however I want to say. Yes, and Dan, thank you so much for coming to World Labor Hour.
Thanks so much for having me.
I definitely would like to report back here on the air about some of these conferences coming up at the Univi and everything. And thanks again for coming in. And we've got to get you back again sometime in the future with your guitar, because that was a really great program when you came on. Great song, too, you know, the lyrics and everything. So, so you're listening to the World Labor Hour and WT Listen Support Community Radio Station, and we're going to leave you with a little music. Stay tuned for the Union Edge with host Charles Showalter out of Pittsburgh.
He's got a guest host this week.
Oh, he does? Okay.
Some lady is hosting it. I wish I could. Jenna Post or something like that.
Okay, all right.
And I think they're going to, this segment actually mainly talks about the $15 per hour thing in Seattle.
Okay.
And then evidently the Senate voted down some type of minimum wage thing this week.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't really pay attention to that.
Billionaires say to hell with workers.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
And Kashama Shawant says that, you know, this is a grassroots thing, and mm-hmm. we start with the workers and the people in the communities and stuff mm-hmm. and build from there. So.
Indeed. Okay, so let's tune in next week. In the meantime, be safe and power to the people. Take care. Too much is not enough.